Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, the Stitcher Radio app for your smart device, CairoRadio.com, and the all-new Adore Network at Adore.fm. Let's get started with the episode. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 285 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Special guest, producer extraordinaire Ian Brennan. Will be joining us here shortly. I had the pleasure of talking with Ian. When was this? Oh my God. Last week. And he is a beautiful man. I love him very much. I had the pleasure of actually meeting Ian. This is actually kind of a remote interview that we did together. I had the pleasure of meeting Ian back in October of 2015 when he came over with Bob Forrest, who was on episode 270. And Ian came with him. He was the producer of Bob's solo album. Bob Forrest, of course, from Celebrity Rehab and from the old band Thelonious Monster. Wonderful, wonderful chat with Bob Forrest. I highly suggest you go back and listen to that episode, which is available on Spreaker, by the way. You can check that out, Spreaker.com, or just go to air-raid.net and check it out there. Survival Songs was the first official solo album from Bob Forrest and grapples a lot with the cycle of addiction and recovery. And it's a really great album, and we had a great chat. And Ian produced that, and he actually came with Bob over here to the backyard, and I got to meet him and his wonderful wife, the very, very talented Marilena. Marilena, I think I'm saying that right. Ian's got a new project out, which is up for a Grammy in the category of world music, and it's called the Zomba Prison Project. The album is called "I Have No Everything Here," and it's really, really raw and very real, very real. Recorded by in Malawi in the Zomba prison by prisoners in Africa, man. And just wait until you hear some of this stuff. It's very like these people are not like professional musicians, right? Ian just went to the prison with his wife. Marilena, and they just recorded like all these prisoners and all these like folk tunes and music that these people have written, poems that they have written, and it's just so real. It's so real. You will never hear anything more real than this, and what you're about to hear. I promise you that. It's very emotional. It's very emotional, man. And I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. So we'll be featuring music from the Zomba Prison Project. I Have No Everything Here throughout the episode. And we'll be talking with Ian about that. He's also got a book that's coming out. And I think it's out now. And you can go to ianbrennan.com. We will post a link to that on our show blog. Ian is a very interesting man. He has worked with the likes of, let's see, Flea, Tanarawin, how about Fugazi, Sleater-Kinney, all these amazing bands back in the 90s, and continues to do that today. His passion now is world music, and he's doing a great job with that. The guy's been nominated for four Grammys, has won a Grammy as well. So, very interesting man, and a perfect example of a person who puts art before what's popular, right? His love of art is way more important than putting something out that, you know, the masses will enjoy. So I really, really like that about Ian, and it was a great, great conversation. So once again, I think you guys are really, really going to enjoy it. I gotta say, there's a moth in here. It's flying around my head, dude. I feel like screaming. I feel like screaming. I've got my Nicorette in, chewing on my piece of Nicorette. I've got this fucking moth flying around. Damn it. Little bastard. Anyway, maybe I should cut that part out. I don't know. Let's get to it, shall we? Okay, let's do that. All righty. Let's see. Okay, so we, once again, we're featuring music from the Zomba Prison Project. It's very raw, very real music here, people. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful with all of its flaws. It's just gorgeous music. And best of luck to Ian Brennan for the Grammy nod in the world music category. I really hope he takes another one home. So, and I hope the people that recorded the music over in Malawi take one home too. There's some people since they recorded this album have been freed from prison. And we'll talk about that a little bit more with Ian. He knows a lot more about it than I do. Okay, so let's go with our first musical break. This one's called Listen to Me, or I'll Kick Your Ass. All right, from the Zomba Prison Project, produced by none other than Ian Brennan. All right, be back in a moment with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
Zona mwana we kunja kwa wapya buluzi waize chitego chinampana matenda etzi vela mwana we malangiza iwe udzakula. Ana liboso anza koyena wosa upeza vela mwana we malangizo iwe udzakula vela mwana we malangizo.
He's got back from Malawi.
Yeah, we just got back from Zomba, the prison there in Malawi, and also other parts of Malawi. We visited with the Malawi Mouse Boys, and then we went to Rwanda, and again, which was beautiful. And now I'm in California.
Man, are you tired?
Yeah, I'm a bit tired, I guess. But you know, I mean. Considering it's not so bad. I mean, I try not to complain in general.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess after kind of integrating yourself into the culture and integrating yourself in with the people there at the prison, it's you got to take everything else with a grain of salt, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a great feat to be able to look at the circumstances of so many other people and realize how fortunate we are. I think it's probably more of an effort and more of a feat for people to kind of wallow in their own misery sometimes,
rather than celebrating,
you know, how fortunate the majority of people are the majority of the time.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. I was checking out a lot of this stuff today. By the way, the latest project that you're working on is called the Zomba Prison Project. Right. The album is I Have No Everything Here, which I find to be a very powerful name to an album.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. And I've just been kind of looking at the photos today and watched the little mini documentary that Al Jazeera did on it. And I'm blown away at what you guys accomplished over there. And I like, how did this all come about? What what started this?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been making records for 30 years and, you know, I started doing field recording with local bands in San Francisco in the 90s. And, my wife and I, Marilena Deli, have made an effort, concerted effort, to try to give voice, bigger voice internationally to places that we just can't find records from or that are underrepresented. The idea of recording in a prison had also been an idea that had been simmering in the background for a long time. So kind of the two worlds came together there in Malawi, where we'd already been and recorded with the Malawi Mouse Boys, who are now releasing their third record. And so we had the opportunity to go into the prison, and we did, and the results were astounding, you know, considering that we didn't know what we would find there.
So you had no idea, like, the musicality of the people that you were going to be talking with and interacting with? Like, that wasn't a part of what went into the initial idea?
No, I mean, you know, it's funny. There's kind of the safety net, in this case, a safety net of knowing that there was an official band there, but knew nothing of them. And in fact, the record is not of the band at all. It's of more than half of the songs are from the women, who have nothing. I mean, they have no instruments. They have two hand drums and some homemade percussion.
Yeah.
And then even with the people that are involved in the band, the project was to try to encourage songwriting and to, you know, to look at the bigger picture and also the microcosm, which is within the group, there was a hierarchy. So we were trying to encourage the people to come out from the margins of that group. And you know, the better songs came from the more reluctant and bashful members that literally had no voice in the group. You know, one of the best songs on the record, it came from the guy who's like the backup bass player and never sings in the band and never writes. He wrote a song and sang, and it's amazing.
What song is that?
It's the second song on the record. It's called "Taking Care of Business," and it's the most modern sounding song on the record.
Uh-huh.
Probably not totally coincidentally, because he's one of the younger people on the record. I think he was like 23 at the time.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And when did you guys do the initial recordings for this?
We did the initial recording in August 2013, and then we just went back again. We felt kind of a obligation, really, to go back and see everyone and give them even more money, even though the project's been a money-losing project. You know, it just was so successful that we felt that should be acknowledged and recognized. And again, it was, you know, personally enriching to go back in unexpected ways, you know, just to really deepen the understanding of the people and to see four of them that are now released was quite amazing, to spend time with them outside the prison one afternoon. And also just to be reminded that we had not exaggerated things or distorted things in our own minds, that it's actually pretty bad there.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I had read about, I want to go back to you just said, like, four of the people that are featured on the record were released after this record came out. But it sounded like a lot of the people that you recorded are in for life sentences in this prison. And it's from everything kind of ranging from murder to thievery?
Yeah, I mean, the age range was 22 to 70.
Wow.
And there were two women that sang on the record that were 70 years old, which, you know, if you take a step back from that, it's pretty astounding to be 70 in Malawi, because the life expectancy for their generation was late 30s.
Wow.
So they basically doubled the life expectancy of their generation. It's improved a lot since then for the new generation, but it's still, you know, hovering in the 40s or early 50s. And the crimes range from basically, you know, nothing, you know, meaning small crimes, but also innocence to you know, murder and even in double murder in one case.
Oh, my gosh.
The concern is that, you know, there are quite a few people there that are there for bureaucratic reasons. So
right.
Three of the cases that we have been fighting for over 2 years, are there because they've lost the file. And one of the women died in the interval between when we were there in August 2013 and now. Somebody who ostensibly maybe could have been released. We just don't know. Nobody really knows because the file is missing.
Yeah.
And we spent the last day there right before we went to the airport in the Supreme Court for Malawi going through the files because the staff there basically was unwilling to do it, but they allowed us to do it to try to find this file until they finally acknowledged that they had officially lost them. You know, just piles and piles of files. So it's a range, you know, what people are there for.
Yeah, yeah. And so did like the record coming out, did it kind of bring some sight into for lack of a better term to what was going on at the prison?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's now maybe the nomination has. I don't think the record so much has.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we donated even more money out of our own pocket. When you find out about the utility of the money, when you find out that, you know, basically you can bail somebody out for about $165, you can get their case appealed for around $250.
Uh-huh.
That's some heavy impact for, you know, not a small amount of money, but certainly not a huge amount of money to have such an impact on somebody's life.
Right,
where they could literally be a free person for $65. And, yeah. And you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, with the nomination and with all the media attention, with all the people that have visited, you know, the BBC and Al Jazeera and Voice of America and New York Times and, all, you know, all these people going there. Whether the change will come, but to the prison officials' credit, I mean, they're pretty realistic and open that you know, they know that conditions are not that good. They know that they're the number one poorest country in the world, and they know that in almost every single culture, prisons kind of come last. I mean, you know, they're the last to receive funding. You know, schools are going to get it before them, and a lot of other, you know, agencies are going to receive the money before they ever do. So really, considering what they're up against, they probably do kind of an okay job in some ways. You know, I think it's hard to take the moral high ground when we're the number one or number two highest incarceration rate in the world, depending on what survey you look at, you know, here in the United States.
Sure. Yeah, I would agree with you. I would agree with you on that one. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a business over here.
Yeah, it's become a business, which is kind of a conflict of interest, let's say.
To say the least.
Yes, to say the least. Yeah.
Well, I'm very impressed with what you've done here, man, and it sounds really good. Now you're coming over, you're on your way here pretty soon, this week actually, to come to Portland, Oregon to do a book reading as well. You're a very busy man, Ian.
Oh, well, you know, I think most of us are. Most people are in their own ways. But yeah, it's been a busy period.
Yeah. The book is called How Music Dies. And this is your fourth book?
It is. I mean, the fourth published book.
Okay.
And it's the first one on music. Kind of ties together. I think the first two books were on anger management and violence prevention. And the third book is about almost a memoir, but it's a novella about the aftermath of sexual violence, something that I unfortunately experienced as the partner of someone who experienced a very horrible and violent assault, which they're all horrible and violent, but you know, a very gratuitous one. And the new book is kind of bringing together some of the violence prevention stuff and integrating that into music, because, you know, for me, music is a violence prevention tool, and I think it's a form of healing potentially, and a great act of social work when it's done right.
Right. Yeah. Totally. I agree with you. Are you there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for some reason I thought the book was about I was unable to get a copy of this because it actually just came out, right?
Yes, yeah, it's still not out. They've had a little delay
with the
publishing. I have not seen a physical copy. I hopefully will see one in Portland. Yes.
But I was under the impression that this book was about your work in Africa. Apparently not.
Well, you know, it is. It is.
Okay.
You know, it's mixed in. There are I think 11, chronicles of the different, some of the trips, some of the records, not mm-hmm. all of them,
mm-hmm.
And interspersed. And then also throughout the book, there's little anecdotes from the different experiences and the different travels, as well as a little background. I mean, only in the sense of trying to give context to it. I mean, it's not a memoir. I'm not a famous person, but just trying to give a sense of maybe where some of this comes from. You know, that
sure.
You know, growing up in the suburbs as a punk rock metal kid, and how you end up years and years later doing something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Totally. So, but it all centers around an incident of sexual violence on somebody that you were together with.
Oh, that was. I'm sorry. That I probably didn't explain that well. That was the third book.
Oh, that was the third book. Okay.
Yeah, that was the novella. So, gotcha. That is related to the violence prevention stuff, but in a fictionalized way. And this book is exclusively. I mean, not exclusively, but it's the one that's about music.
Gotcha.
It's the first one about music.
Okay.
So, yeah, I probably didn't explain that well.
I am tracking now, sir.
Okay. Well, good.
One thing that I noticed in this latest batch of recordings, the last time I met you, you had come with Bob Forrest over to the house. We were doing our episode with Bob, you were the producer on that album, which I thought was fantastic. And one thing that I noticed that is kind of one of your mainstays is like recording in the environment in which somebody is comfortable. Like on Bob's record, you recorded a lot of the music out on the deck in a cabin in Big Sur.
Right.
And then in this the Zomba prison project, you recorded a lot of the music in basically what I would call a hut. Right?
Right.
No sound deadening, no nothing. You getting the ambient noises of what's going on around you, as well as the music. Is that something that you consciously made a decision on, or is it just because there wasn't any other facility to use while you were there?
Well, I mean, I guess it's been an evolution away from kind of the height of artificial recording of a certain sort, which was, you know, the multi-track recording in the 80s. Now with auto-tuning and that stuff, it's even more severe in a certain way. But, I just kind of learned through trial and error, or just out of necessity, that a lot of the things that I'd concerned myself with, or had been taught to concern myself with, like you're talking about, isolation and sound deadening and mm-hmm. and ambient noises, were not necessarily important, in the sense that oftentimes they're not even really there, in the finished product to the degree that people might think. And so with the field recording, I guess, you know, that led into that, in San Francisco, doing it in cafes and clubs.
Yeah.
And then now, to the point that I actually prefer recording outdoors, if given the choice, because it's a very neutral, dead environment, really, but at the same time alive. But there's not that reflectivity that it occurs in rooms.
Your sound isn't bouncing off of walls, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's not. I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to jinx myself, but in general. I try my best to get good sound, and I try my best to isolate as much as I can. But at the same time, with digital recording, we have a lot of advantages, and one of them is, you know, the ability to edit later. And I found that usually what you get is a good, you know, it colors itself. I mean, it's going to have a sound as it should of the place where it was recorded. So. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to situate people in a place that they're comfortable, and also that the recording should bear some of the DNA of where it was born, and not sound artificial, as if it, you know, was interchangeable with any studio in the world. And unfortunately, that's kind of the way the system's been set up, is that you can record in Seattle or record in South Africa or record in Tokyo, and it's all kind of the same. And that's absurd, you know, because nothing else is the same.
Yeah.
You know, when you're there, it feels different in different places. The temperature is different. And cities sound different. I mean, Seattle sounds different than even San Francisco, even another West Coast city.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that explanation.
I've never
really thought about it that way, but yeah, you're totally right. Like, to the layman, especially like myself, like I would categorize myself in this manner, but like I wouldn't be able to tell like something that was recorded in Robert Lang's studios to something that was recorded in a studio in like Sound City or something in L.A. Like I just wouldn't be able to tell.
Yeah,
there's no difference.
Yeah, and it's weird, you know, because you look at like even if you're just talking about recent history and you're talking about, you know, recorded music, which is a pretty young thing. I mean, it's you know, a little over 100 years old or whatever. You know, you look at Sun Records and you know, the room was made to be deliberately reflective. I mean, that was the goal, to be as reflective as possible, to create bleed. That was the sound that Sam Phillips wanted. You know, in New York, a lot of diverse and great recordings were made in the Columbia Studios there that has super high ceilings and has a very distinct sound in that room. So they did Sketches of Spain there. They did, Simon and Garfunkel records there, very different records. And, you know, the room had a beautiful sound, but it was unstoppable. You know, you couldn't, if you recorded there, it was going to sound like that room.
Right,
because there was no other room really like it, and I think that's the way it should be, and I think it's kind of cart before the horse when people are trying to make something sound like something when it already sounds like something. Just let it be what it is, and celebrate that.
Yeah, you basically just answered my next question, but do you think we've lost something now?
Well, you know, I don't know
just
if we've lost something,
a uniqueness. Maybe?
Well, you know, I think just we have big challenges. The big challenges are recorded music itself. You know, it's a double-edged sword. There's many beautiful things about it, the portability of it, the ability for people to be exposed to music privately without anyone else there, even the performer, the fact that people's voices can live on posthumously. These are all pretty incredible things, but they also bring with them a lot of negatives, and part of the negative is the repetition, you know, which is not good for us neurologically, and we lose the transmission of airs, or the airs in transmission, which are so important to folk culture. You know, the folk culture is based on me not being that good at playing what you want me to play. You know, like you play a great song and I try to play it and I don't play it quite right, but over time that creates maybe a whole new genre almost, or something new.
Sure.
And we do lose that, you know, and the big thing now I think is literally that things are being put on a grid, you know, and music, you know, a lot of times people say music is mathematical, and that's partially true, but it's partially false.
Yeah.
A lot of it is inexplicable. And even on a mathematical level, a lot of it is very, very hard to quantify. So what the grid does is kind of forces things into slots that don't necessarily exist, you know, that are close, they're approximations. You know, when you listen to an MP3, you're listening to an approximation of a sound. You know, most of the sound is left implied for us, you know, in terms of our perceptual abilities to fill in. It's suggesting sound to us.
Because it's digital?
Particularly with the MP3s. I mean, the way they make the smiles, the file so small is by eliminating most of the data.
Right.
I think there's dangers there. Again, I mean, there's good things and there's bad things, like with everything. But, I don't think this is being a Luddite, and I don't think it's old fogyism to say that in the cycle of recorded music that we're at a crossroads, so to speak. You know, we've been there before, but the cultural inertia of having now over 100 years of recorded music is a big thing. It's a big thing to be up against.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you prefer, vinyl, tape, MP3, wax ring?
What do you prefer? What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound is probably right now. It's probably vinyl.
Yeah,
and I can go for cassette from time to time, but I it's just so clunky. Like it doesn't matter to me that much to have cassette, you know.
Yeah.
For the sound of it.
Yeah.
But I think vinyl, because it's warm, it's crackly. You know, you get the ambient noise off the actual vinyl itself, you know?
Yeah.
Plus the music.
Physical medium.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
And music is physical.
Right.
I mean, by nature, it's physical. And so, I mean, I like vinyl, but in general, I'm not a big sonic person. I'm much more concerned about the emotion being conveyed and the range of what I think does that successfully with recorded music is so wide, you know, mm-hmm. everything from something recorded on a boombox, you know, by somebody in their, you know, bedroom at 4 a.m, to, you know, really orchestrated things like TV on the Radio or Queen, or, you know, they're at the good end of the spectrum of what can be done with multi-tracking.
Sure, sure.
But I think, unfortunately, most people are just in the middle of all that, and it's kind of stale and predictable.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that. You're a true purist, man.
I guess so. Yeah, or lazy.
Lazy.
Yeah, a little of both.
I like that. you're a pure realist. That's what it is.
Okay, good. Good.
Well, let's do this. Ian, let's take our second musical break. We're featuring music today from the Zomba Prison Project. This one really, really got to me. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know exactly what the woman is singing about, but just the name of the song, Please Don't Kill My Child, really kind of conveys, you know, a very strong message to you.
It does.
And
it does.
What language is this sung in?
It's Chichewa, which Chichewa. Is the primary language in Malawi, and it was classified by the BBC once as the second most musical language after Italian. So it's quite beautiful.
Oh, it is.
A lot of the names have a lot of alliteration in them.
Yeah.
And the individuals' names, but that song, Please Don't Kill My Child, is so beautiful, and it's also very chilling because it's a reality that in their culture that it's not uncommon for people to kill another person's child as an act of revenge.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's what the song is about?
Yep. It's, it's sobering. I mean, that somebody would feel compelled to do that. And Malawi is a great place. It's called the Warm Heart of Africa. So I'm not trying to paint it in any negative form, but this is one of those anomalies. I mean, we've certainly got them here, with mass shootings and that sort of thing that
oh, sure.
are fairly unique to us. And in their culture, they have this aspect that, you know, they're certainly probably not the only culture, but it is a very dark aspect of their culture.
Ugh, man, that just breaks my heart.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Absolutely breaks my heart. Okay, well, let's get everybody super sad.
And yeah.
let's go with our second musical break. Please Don't Kill
yes.
My Child by the Zomba Prison Project off of the album I Have Know Everything Here. We're talking with producer Ian Brennan, and we'll be back in a moment with more of the Ear Raid Podcast for your ears when we return. Stay with us. Kundi pera mwana kodi anala kwa chani chosa ndi uzaine abale Mukundi pera mwana kodi anala kwa chani chosa ndi uzaine abale Mukundi pera mwana kodi anala kwa chani chosa ndi uzaine abale mwana wanga Yo, analakwa chani
futika na yendeka kumulela kumulela ndeka kuchipatala tafutika naye tafutika naye anala kwa chani mwanayo kumulela ndeka mwana wanga
that part in.
All right. No, I mean it. We need more good people.
Oh man, that's so sweet, dude. When you sent me that package of music, I was like, cause a lot of people, and I'm going to be totally truthful with you. Like a lot of people come in here, we have great conversations with a lot of people, and a lot of people leave here and go, oh, I'm going to send you this. I'm going to send you some music. I'm going to send you this book, you know, that I read. And some people do. But I would say probably 95% of them do not, you know,
and
getting that package of music from you, with the letter and stuff like that, you know, saying like, this is what we talked about. You know, I told you I was going to send you this stuff. I was like, oh man, that's refreshing.
Oh, nice. I'm glad.
Yeah, man.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also we should say that the Zomba prison project is, nominated for a Grammy this year too.
It is, which is totally shocking, but a really nice thing. It's been a really nice thing for the country of Malawi itself. They've never had a nomination in the 58 years of the Grammys, which the majority of African countries never have, and the majority of Asian countries never have either for popular music.
Right.
For classical music, so more countries have in Europe and Asia and in Africa, but for pop music, many countries have never had a single nomination.
That's pretty cool, man. So does it really surprise you though? I mean, this is the fifth nomination that you have produced.
Well, it's for me, it's the fourth now. There'll be a fifth soon. You know, it really was shocking because they reduced the categories 4 years ago in an effort to make things more competitive. And a lot of that was, it's all well intended. And a lot of it was probably wise. They had categories that had only a few more entries than nominees. So
right.
The meaning of that was obviously going to be reduced to some degree. So that aspect was good. The negative aspect is what it leads to in some cases is that things become celebrity driven.
Right. And, yeah.
You know, with world music, it should be the most crazy, unpredictable, you know, the category of all, because you're drawing on basically all of the non-English, non-Spanish-speaking world, which is, you know, the majority of the world, something like 86% of the world.
Right.
So to see the same names over and over and over again is very disheartening, because there's so much good music out there that just doesn't get heard. So to get a nomination for literally an unknown group of people that can never tour, that most of them are in prison still, and many of them will be there for the rest of their lives, is an incredible thing, because it's really the Grammys at their best, because it was based on merit alone, exclusively.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I'm one of those people, too, that, like, I don't really... Well, I, you know, just doing this show, like I hear a lot of stuff that's outside of my comfort zone, you know?
Yeah.
We get a lot of stuff sent to us. But I'm not somebody, before I started this show, I was never somebody who actually sought that kind of thing out. Like, I would never go and listen to world music at all. Like, it just wasn't something that I was interested in, nor was I aware of, really, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you hear it in movies. It's, you know, it's used as backing tracks and stuff like that for television shows and movies and stuff for dramatic effect or to put you in a place. But, like, never would I go out and actually seek this stuff out. How did it come to you that way? Like, what brought you into the fold, into the world of world music?
Well, you know, I mean, I think for me it was, you know, I'm sustained now with it through the math of it. When I look at the inequities mathematically, it just becomes clear that obviously, given the choice, someone who's never been heard from, literally entire cultures, I would rather listen to them. But beyond that, the songs have to stand for themselves, and the music must come first. I think without that, it's all almost counterproductive,
sure,
because it can,
sure,
it can backfire. But it started for me, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was making records, and I just grew tired of the same thing over and over again. I particularly grew tired, it was not an entirely conscious process, but of the hype system, where I really was trying to keep track and follow, you know, what I was supposed to, you know. In other words,
right,
you'd read
right.
about something, it would be like, this is the greatest record of the year, blah, 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 blah. And this is in the days when you had to go out and, you know, spend $10 to $20 to hear it. And, you know, to do that over and over again and be disappointed by hearing the same crap over and over again, which is basically, you know, white guys with guitars and bass and drums, singing in English. You know, I just began to gravitate towards other things. You know, it was a slow process, but that's really the origin of it, was just that kind of disappointment and feeling cheated over and over again by these, you know, hyped up expectations which were rarely met.
Yeah, yeah. But as like a producer, or I'm guessing you probably started as like an engineer, right?
No, not really. I started as a musician.
Okay.
I don't consider myself an engineer to this day, but I've learned it out of necessity.
Right, right. So, but like starting out, like, what were you listening to? What type of music were you playing?
Well, for me, I mean, growing up, it was, you know, a diet of you know, heavy metal, punk, and heartland rock. Which is probably an odd mix, but
so
I was motivated.
A ton of Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, you got it. Thin Lizzy was awesome because he wrote good lyrics, you know, he was an amazing artist, Phil Lynott. But for me, the motivation was, besides love and music, the motivation was that I looked at poetry, which I was interested in being a writer, and I realized that basically nobody but academics read Ted Hughes, but people could quote lyrics from pop artists that sucked and could barely write their way out of a paper bag. So I thought,
right.
You know, try to merge these two things. And I think occasionally artists do that, but it's very rarely that they do. But, you know, that was my motivation, was to try to bring, you know, hopefully a higher level of writing to music. And I think, even though it's in a foreign language, a lot of the artists that I've worked with have done that. And a lot of times I don't know till after the fact, but you kind of sense that there's something there. And then when I receive the translations, it's often surprising, but in an affirmation, like, wow, this is really well written, this song. You know, it's what I'd expected, but there's always that fear that maybe it's poorly written or even that it contains offensive lyrics. You know? You don't necessarily know.
I never thought about that. That's a distinct possibility, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. You know, you might be, in a sense, endorsing something that is, you know, vile without knowing it.
Right, right. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Obviously, that's come up before.
Well, you know, fortunately, as far as I know, it hasn't.
Oh, okay, good.
You know, but there's all the, you know, there's that fear, which has led me to want to delve more deeply into the meaning of the song, even if there aren't, you know, 100% translated lyrics.
Sure, sure, yeah. But you've worked with some pretty big names in your life, man.
I guess, you know? Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of it in the live setting as well. You know?
Fugazi's on that list, dude. That's a pretty huge accomplishment in my book.
Well, you know, those guys are amazing. I think for a lot of people, yourself, myself, and they were very inspirational. And they're good people. They're good friends now as well. Helped organize the music for the 20th anniversary of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, and Fugazi agreed to do it, and then Sleater-Kinney agreed to do it, and Vic Chestnut agreed to do it, and it was just an incredible experience, an incredible day in my life, and when Fugazi agreed to come across the country to do this concert, their fear was that nobody would come. Not nobody, but they just said, you know,
right,
is anybody going to show up? And no one had a way of knowing. It was a free show. And by police estimates, there were 10 to 15,000 people there in this little tiny city park, Dolores Park in the Mission. And
oh my God.
It was totally peaceful, no trouble, barely had any security there. So it was just beautiful on a bunch of different levels that you could put on a free concert in what at the time was still considered kind of the periphery of a bad neighborhood. And not have a single fist fight or, you know, any incident whatsoever.
That's cool, man. Like, I remember seeing video of that.
Yeah.
And just being blown away by how many people were there. And then hearing that it was a free concert, like, really, really blew me away.
Oh, wow. That's amazing that you are aware of it and saw the video. Yeah. There's a picture that Ian took from the back of the stage when Sleater-Kinney was playing, and I still look at it occasionally and, you know, see it occasionally, and I'm just amazed at how many people were in the park. Again, it's one of those things where you think, maybe I've distorted it in my own mind, and then I look at the picture, and the picture doesn't lie. It's just like this sea of people, this blanket of heads.
Oh, my God, that's so cool. That's so cool. Yeah. So take me back, Ian. Where did you grow up, man? Where did little Ian Brennan grow?
I grew up in the suburbs of the Bay Area, you know, in what used to be a middle class neighborhood, working class neighborhood, kind of doesn't exist anymore. Like a lot of places, so San Francisco was kind of always the center of the world, you know, like where you would go for culture, where you would go for music, and like a lot of suburbs, it was so new that it was kind of a wasteland culturally, you know, not that it's a bad place, but there was just no sense of place, you know, and maybe that's part of why I'm so interested now in making sure that recordings bear the DNA or the fingerprints of where they were born.
Yeah. Yeah. So was your family very musical?
No, my grandfather, both my grandfathers were Irish tenors.
Tenors?
They were, yeah, yeah. So I guess in the distant, you know, one generation removed, it was there. But in my immediate family, no. I mean, I was obsessed with music from the time I was 5 years old. But otherwise, you know. And my mom played a little piano when she was younger, but otherwise that was my thing. I don't know where it came from, but it just, you know, it's kind of like a bug. I think, you know, some people catch it really bad.
Yeah.
And and it can be fatal. it really can.
Well, yeah, it's killed a few, I think.
Yeah, I think so. more than a few.
Yeah, right, man. So you said earlier that you started out by kind of playing music. Were you just were you strictly guitar, or were you one of those kids that had to like learn and play everything?
I was, as a teenager, obsessive compulsive about guitar. Mm-hmm. I had the misfortune of reading, you know, some quotes from some old jazz guys that said, if you hadn't made it by the time you're 18, you'll never make it. So I felt this self-imposed deadline that I had to master the guitar by the time I was 18. And so I literally would lock myself in my room and just play every waking hour that I could, which is sometimes 12 hours a day or more. And unfortunately, what I was practicing was not very useful. I was learning to jam, you know,
right,
because that
right.
was the thing I wanted, you know, as a 14-year-old kid, that's what I wanted to be able to do was to play like Eddie Van Halen or David Gilmour or whoever, you know. And
right.
So I went on to, you know, to teach myself, again, out of necessity, a lot of other instruments, you know, in a rudimentary way, but, you know, guitar and singing and writing was always what I was interested in.
Uh-huh. Did you have a lot of friends there that you actually, like, fiddled around with or jammed with?
You know, some, but I mean, again, it was kind of a cultural wasteland in that period. It was, you know, part of what I talk about in the book is this idea of, with the commercialization of music, that music becomes something that is outside of you rather than inside of you, and it's something you have to purchase. You have to go buy a prescribed item to make music with. I think that's a very dangerous thing. You know, if you look at the history of mankind, up until just a couple of generations ago, the exceptional family member was the one who did not play music. That was the weirdo. That was the one who stood out.
Mm-hmm.
Now the exceptional family member is the one who does play music. And when they do, in most cases, they don't really, you know. Somebody goes, oh, my kid's a musician. And it's like,
right.
Okay, you know. And what do? They pick up a guitar and they go, dun, 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 dun. You know, over and over again, you know. And that's the colonialization aspect of recorded music that's so scary, you know, is that you know, more and more places in the world, music has been reduced to, you know,
smoke on the water,
Stairway to Heaven. You know, three generations now in, you know, kids are still listening to, you know, what's great music, but at the same time, it's hard to not feel that we're not stuck in some kind of feedback loop that's not necessarily healthy.
So how do you think we get out of that? Like, is it an education thing? Is it getting those programs, like, back in schools and things like that?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, once people begin to make money off of anything, we were talking about prisons earlier.
Right.
I mean, once there's profit in something, healthcare, oil, music, there's obviously going to be people that are going to defend that system being sustained.
And, right. Well, that's why they call it motive, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I mean it's a scary thing, and you know there's that bumper sticker, you know, real musicians have day jobs, and I think to a large degree that's true. Is that you know, once somebody's doing it for money, it's hard for them not to become a bit of a trained seal, and you see that. I mean, I think most of us see that there's that rare artist that probably deserves a lifetime career.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a very rare individual. I think
really?
Most people are musical. Most people have at least one good song. Maybe that's it, one good song. And that's what they should probably offer to the world, and then they should go away. You know, I really believe that there should be anti-recording contracts. You know, people should be paid to not make records. Like, please stop making records. You know, retroactively, please.
Yeah.
Unrelease the albums that you've released.
can you please give me an example?
Oh,
I don't want you to bury yourself here, but could you possibly just give me an example?
Well, I think almost anybody who's ever put out more than two or three records is probably to be examined for this. But I can say personally, for me, what happens, you know, with most musical artists in the recorded era is that the minute that they become a really, really good performer of their records, because it's cart before the horse, they have to kind of go back and learn how to play something that was studio made.
Right.
Then usually the creative spark begins to die or is already gone. So, and so you look at Springsteen. I love Springsteen, and I love him from, you know, 1973 to 1982.
Yeah.
And not everything he did in that period either.
Okay.
And then since, I think in terms of recording, what he's done is really not good. And he's tried. But as a live performer, he's still incredible.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, he's still amazing. So, I mean, I think there's an example right there.
Okay. Well, that's a good even keeled example, my friend.
Yeah, it'll probably anger a lot of people. But you know, he made his Rost record with Nebraska in 1982. It's so influential, and people don't recognize the dramatic influence that record had. This massive American rock star recorded a record, you know, on a 4-track Tascam cassette machine and left the mistakes in there. And, you know, I mean, the guitar playing in places just completely falls apart, and
right.
he left it. And I don't think it's totally probably a coincidence that he went on to do an incredibly commercial record. I think that, I don't know, maybe it was shocking to him to, you know, feel like maybe his career was slipping away, you know, because the other record commercially was not a massive success. And of course, in that era, not a massive success. I think it still sold like almost 1 million copies when it came out, but
right,
comparatively to what he'd been doing, it was, you know, a step backwards.
Now, do you think, okay, this is something that I constantly mull over in my head too, because I'm a bit younger than you, and now all the people that I listened to when I was a teenager are now coming out with, like, you know, they're coming out with new albums, right?
Yeah.
You know, all those 90s bands and stuff coming back out with new albums, and I'm with you, man. I think it sounds terrible. It's awful. They're trying to rehash a sound that meant something 20 years ago or 30 years ago and doesn't have the same impact now. Right.
Right.
And,
right.
But I can't figure out for the life of me if people actually like it, because they seem to still sell well, but I can't figure out if people actually like it, or they just like it for a nostalgia factor, or you know, What is it? What makes people buy this stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's so much of the recorded music and the commercialization of it is about identity, and you know, I think music at its best is inclusive. It's something that brings people together. But I think one of the faults of kind of the quote-unquote indie rock world is it does the opposite. It's designed to basically be exclusive and to push others away and to almost degrade them for their lack of knowledge of something. Mm-hmm. And with that comes a lot of, you know, fake knowledge, you know, where people claim that they were into something that they weren't. You know, it's a lie. You know, and I told this guy from Rolling Stone back in, I think, 91, I said, the Pixies in 20 years are going to come back and they're going to play Houston Astrodome, and it's going to be full of people that claim that they saw them in a 500-seat club.
Right, and right.
It basically happened. I mean, I was joking, you know, but I thought it could happen, but I never thought it would. And in essence, it did happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And deservedly so. I mean, what they did during their peak was incredible, you know, and that's part of the you know, the cultural inertia, is that it took people that long to catch up to it.
Right. But, you know, part of that, I think, is just where media was at the time, too. Like, they didn't have, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago, we didn't have the internet to tell us, you know, and we didn't have social media that people were sharing this stuff constantly back and forth. Check out this song, check out this video, you know, everything like that. Like, you know, a band like the Pixies, who never saw, you know, major mainstream success, was mostly due to the machine, right? Like, of big, big record label bands.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still going on in certain forms. The one thing with the digital age is that the number of releases is more than doubled. You know, so in the U.S. alone, they're estimating about 100,000 releases a year.
Right.
So there's this idea of you know, this democracy and you know, that everybody has a fair chance, and it really, promotions become more important than ever.
Right, right.
And I think at its best, these things, again, they're all, you know, there's truth and there's mistruth to a lot of this. And, you know, there are aspects of it that maybe make things more democratic, but a lot of it's very idealized and a lot of it's not realized. And it's that way with the internet. You know, there's kind of these images of freedom and connectivity. But, you know, I just got back from Malawi and Rwanda and basically had no internet the entire time I was in either country.
Right, yeah.
You know, so, and my world data plan that used to work in those countries doesn't anymore. They've cut back. They've actually cut back probably because they realized that it was too expensive for the companies to provide that service that they used to provide.
Sure.
You know, I think, you know, in theory, a lot of it's great, but, you know, a lot of the people I'm dealing with are living without electricity, without clean water, you know, with, you know, literally on the edge of starvation. And so, you know, we got a lot of challenges that are much bigger than those that, you know, the people in Silicon Valley claim are what matters.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree with you on that, too. But I can't seem to get myself off of it. Like, that's the crux of it, too, for a guy like me, is, like, you can't, like, I'm for some reason, there's a fear to getting rid of a Facebook page.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, where the fuck does that come from? How did that enter my brain space? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I think it's dangerous when, again, we talk about people profiting from things, and I think profiting from social impulse is a pretty parasitic thing.
Oh, it totally is.
Yeah.
Because it's most
so strong.
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
I mean, and that's you know, you can go on like a, you know, you do a Google search, right? I mean, it's so insidious now. You do a Google search for, like, I was looking for a rain jacket the other day. And for, like, by this small kind of rain jacket maker called Filson. And then all of a sudden I'm on, you know, the New Yorker website reading an article, and what pops up in the margin is a Filson ad.
Right.
You know, it's like, I mean, everything, all this data is just going into one spot and watching what you listen to, what you watch, what, you know, what you're looking for to buy and stuff like that. It's insane.
Yep.
And we can't get ourselves away from it.
No, it's fairly irreversible. So I think it's a matter of managing it, you know.
Sure.
And I think the big lie is that it's transformative. And when we're looking at, you know, human nature, when you're looking at the reptilian stem, I mean, it's got, you know, tens of thousands of years, if not more, advantage over anything that we're introducing now.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's human nature is not going to change overnight for the better. And in some ways it can be enabled for the worse, but if you want to get off the internet, go to Malawi or Rwanda. You'll be forced off for a couple of days at least.
I mean, are you the type of guy that, like, did you feel like an appendage was missing a little bit, or are you more easily letting go of those kind of things?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think it's unnatural to, you know, it's a rhythm that gets interrupted.
Sure.
But I can welcome it. I think it is though the fear of, because that rhythm is interrupted, that for people that you are used to relating with in particular, you know, everybody's got their circle of intimate people, and then, you know, you know, maybe business acquaintances, that sort of thing. And so to suddenly just be gone without real, you know, any forewarning, you just hope that, you know, in 5 days' time or a week's time when you're back online, that there's not something really bad, but again, I mean, I think that's that false sense of control. It's not as if I found out about some bad news the instant it happened would change the fact that it had happened.
Right. Yeah, totally. Well, now I feel like super honored that you took the time to find an internet cafe and send me an email from Malawi.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. There you go.
So, well, we're running a little low on time, dude. Let's see. The book is coming out soon, right?
Yeah, it's coming out in February.
Okay. And let's see. What's the name of it again? How Music Dies?
Yeah, How Music Dies or Lives. Field Recording and the Battle for Democracy in the Arts.
I love it. And you're probably going to be hitting on a lot of the stuff that we talked about today, huh?
Yeah, certainly that, and hopefully in the book there's even more. Maybe there's too much, you know. It was kind of short, and it ended up being very, very long.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah.
Was it hard for you to sit down and write this stuff?
Well, I mean, I think writing is, you know, like people say, the best part of writing is having written. You know, it's not usually much of an enjoyable process and all of that, but you know, a lot of it was just formulated, but then helping myself to think more clearly about some of these issues and also to delve more deeply into some of the factual material. It's not an academic book, but to look into it, you know, more deeply. And you know, I just hope that, like with records and books, I think that ideally they're designed not to provide answers, they're designed to provoke questions. And the more information and knowledge we have, the more doubt we should have about the world, really.
Sure.
The more we should, you know, embrace ambiguity and look for the nuance in things and hopefully see things in less of a extreme or black and white way. And so hopefully the book, you know, for those who might read it, you know, just provoke some questions and gets them to reflect even more. They probably already are, but even more on what they listen to. And really, that's the point, is just that pop music tends to be trivialized, and it's not trivial at all. It is everywhere.
Yeah.
And it may not be as central to our culture as it was in the 60s or 70s, but it's still vitally important. And,
yeah.
And I think a lot of the stuff that happens negatively with commercialization starts with music. So it's a good thing to watch it closely, because it can grow from there into even bigger and more mean and insidious things.
Right. Well, it's become, you know, like we were talking about earlier, it's become a commodity.
Yeah.
And you got to be careful with that kind of stuff, because you don't know what's behind it.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Ian, it's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Yeah, dude. This is a lot of fun. You can find out more about Ian at his website, ianbrennan.com. We'll have a link to that on our webpage. And then the Zomba Prison Project is out now that you can find. Once again, the album is called I Have No Everything Here. And it's up for a Grammy this year. Best of luck on that, Ian. Maybe you can be a two-time winner now.
Well, you know, I don't know, but it's beautiful that the record and the prisoners have been recognized.
Yeah, man, that's super great. Do you go to these ceremonies?
I have gone in the past. It's fascinating, really.
It's got to be a pretty incredible people watching scenario.
It is. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, once again, thank you so much. And the album is great. I really, really, really enjoy your work, man.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, there you have it, folks. Ian Brennan, producer, author, all around great human being, doing a lot of good in this world, and doing what he can to help people out and help people get their voices heard. Man, I really admire this man. I really, really admire this man. And big, big, big thanks to Ian for coming on the show. If you'd like to find out more, please visit his website, ianbrennan.com. That's IANBRENNAN.com. Okay? The book, by the way, is called How Music Dies or Lives: Field Recording and the Battle for Democracy in the Arts. Okay? And that should be out now on Allworth and Skyhorse out of NYC. So you can go to, once again, ianbrennan.com and maybe get yourself a copy of that, or go to your local bookstore. Okay? Oh, man. Okay. This was great conversation. Great conversation. Thank you guys so much for listening. We hope you guys enjoyed yourselves. I'm still battling this moth. What am I going to do about this? Should get like a bug bomb or something. No, I'm not going to do that for one moth. Come on. Come on. Not that type of guy. All right. You can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. Only takes a couple seconds to leave a star rating, and it helps us out immensely in the long run. We are also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, Cairo Radio, and Spreaker apps. Or you can just go to air-raid.net and subscribe directly to our RSS feed. Keep in touch with us by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast. Our Twitter handle is @airraidnet. You can keep in touch that way as well. Tweet to us. Or email me directly at aaron@air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge, folks. Take the pledge to tell somebody about the show. If you just heard this for the first time and you liked it, tell somebody, bring it up in conversation. Tell somebody that you found an amazing podcast that you want to share with them, okay? All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. It has been wonderful, wonderful being your guest inside your brains this week. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode with Jack Quaid, the son of Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid, who's in the all-new HBO series Vinyl, which premieres Sunday, February 14th. So, new episode of Air Raid with Jack Quaid coming up, Monday the 15th, all right? Right after the premiere of Vinyl. This song is called The Floods by the Zomba Prison Project. We love you guys. Enjoy this music. Spread it around. And good luck in the Grammys. Have a great week, everybody.
Muntawi anoa boga na ufulu anoa Adane rama ubera niti zaseme chombo liguza tiku kuzafika chikumula liguza tiku kuzafika chikumula. Muntu sine ai koma Yesu yemweu anagonjesa imfa muli mpamvu mwazi wake simugudzi wa godi mai ndikudza tsiku kudzafika chikumula ndikudza tsiku kudzafika chikumula wobulumutsa muntu sine ai koma Yesu yemweu anagonjesa imfa muli mpamvu mwazi wake simugudzi wa godi mai ndikudza tsiku kudzafika chikumula ndikudza tsiku kudzafika chikumula.